Welcome all to the teleclass, Respiratory and GI Outbreaks in Long-Term Care, Investigation and Control. My name is Paul Weber. On behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to this teleclass. When Dr. Sattar and I started teleclass education, we had three goals, and those goals have remained the same since day one. They're to bring the best possible information to the widest possible audience with the fewest barriers to participation. And the faculty for today's teleclass certainly fits the bill for the best possible education. Dr. Chesley Richards is possibly the top authority in the world on infection control in long-term care facilities. He has been with the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion for many years, and he also gets down into the trenches of infection control through his work at the VA Chronic Care Hospitals in Atlanta. His teleclass on long-term care last year was absolutely outstanding, and I've been looking forward to having him back again for a whole year. To give the teleclass, Respiratory and GI Outbreaks in Long-Term Care, Investigation and Control, from the Centers for Disease Control, I am honored to present Dr. Chesley Richards. Dr. Richards.
Great. Thank you, Paul. It's a great pleasure and honor to be with you this afternoon, and thank you for calling in for this teleclass. I'm on the first slide of the slide set that you should have entitled Respiratory and GI Outbreaks in Long-Term Care, Investigation and Control. And I'm going to proceed now to the next slide where we have the objectives for this afternoon's talk. The first objective is to review elements of outbreak investigation in long-term care facilities with some comments that are specific for respiratory and GI outbreaks. We're also going to discuss infection control approaches in long-term care for outbreaks. And then most of the talk will be discussing the key clinical and epidemiologic features of respiratory and gastrointestinal infectious disease outbreaks in long-term care. Now let's proceed to the next slide. How common are infections in long-term care? If you look at this slide, this is taken from Dr. Larry Straussbaugh's work summarizing a number of studies that are in the literature reporting on rates of infection in long-term care. We don't have a national surveillance system in the U.S., and I'm not aware of one in Canada that looks at long-term care infection systems, so we have to take this from studies that have been published and from the literature. But if you look, respiratory tract infections are probably the most common infections occurring in long-term care. If you look at the rates vary from as low as 0.3 infections per 1,000 patient resident days per year to 4.7. This wide range is in part because of the impact and variability of especially viral respiratory infection outbreaks that can occur. And if you take an average-sized nursing home of 100 beds and you take the median of those rates that I've just described, you have 70 to 80 infections in that nursing home, respiratory infections, in a given year. Likewise, if you look at urinary tract infections, skin and soft tissue infections, and GI infections, you get smaller numbers, around 30 to 40 infections per year. But I want to emphasize that if you have an outbreak, especially a viral respiratory outbreak or a viral gastrointestinal outbreak, you may get a close to 100% attack rate in a given nursing home. So these numbers can vary fairly dramatically. Now going to the next slide, I also want to briefly talk about risk factors for infection in long-term care residents. And these become important in outbreaks in terms of understanding which parts of your long-term care population might be at highest risk both for developing an infection but also for developing a bad outcome from infection. Individual level risk factors are presented here. First of all, we know that as individuals age, there's a decreased immunity to infections, but the decreases in the immune system that are related strictly to aging are actually pretty minor. Most of the decreased immunity we see in residents of long-term care is because of the chronic diseases and comorbidities that they have. Certainly, malnutrition plays an important role in long-term care residents. If residents are losing weight and they're not taking in enough protein and carbohydrates, they certainly are going to be at increased risk of having an infection. Functional impairments such as diminished cough reflex, urinary and fecal incontinence, and immobility certainly increase the risk of infection. Some medications, for instance, immunosuppressives or central nervous system suppressants that may suppress the cough reflex, increase the risk for infection. and then the presence of invasive devices. And we're seeing more and more of these types of invasive devices in long-term care facilities. They increase the risk of infection, but they also complicate the care for patients who develop, for example, a respiratory infection or develop a gastrointestinal infection. On the next slide, I want to talk a little bit about the institutional level risk factors for nursing home or long-term care populations. First of all, in larger long-term care facilities, we know there's a risk, especially with respiratory and viral gastrointestinal outbreaks, for relatively high attack rates. With group activities, and the group activities in a long-term care facility vary, but they certainly include dining activities where residents dine together either in a common dining room or a common room on a particular ward. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, recreational therapy, these are all activities in which large groups are brought together, and they increase the risk of transmission of, again, especially viral respiratory agents. We know that in nursing homes and long-term care facilities that have low immunization rates with influenza and pneumococcal vaccine, there's an increased risk for outbreaks both of influenza and of bacterial pneumonia, especially drug-resistant Streptococcus pneumoniae. We know that in facilities that have excessive antimicrobial use or widespread colonization with antibiotic-resistant bacteria, there's an increased risk of outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant infections. And this is particularly important in terms of the agents we're talking about today, in terms of pneumococcus, where we see multidrug resistance increasing. And then in nursing homes or long-term care facilities where there are single nursing units or multiple units with a single nursing station, we see an increased risk for outbreaks. And this is probably because these types of architectural designs allow for a lot of intermingling between healthcare worker staff, and there is transmission not only from person to person in the nursing home, but person to healthcare worker, between healthcare workers and then to other residents. Moving on, I briefly want to talk for a couple of slides about the unique challenges for investigating and managing outbreaks in long-term care facilities. And I think this is important. I think that infection control professionals and epidemiologists who work directly in long-term care understand some of this, but especially for those of you who may be hospital-based who are going into the long-term care environment less often, I think these are some very important challenges that we face in terms of investigation and management. First of all, the cognitive impairment we see in a lot of our long-term care and nursing home residents complicates our data collection, knowing when a resident has symptoms, being able to communicate with that resident, especially around hand hygiene interventions, and then being able to implement other interventions. Cognitive impairment certainly complicates that. We know that in the nursing home and long-term care population that there are multiple comorbidities and group exposures that I just mentioned. And then I think we also have to wrestle with what are the most appropriate outcomes to be concerned with in a long-term care or nursing home population. Certainly if we see outbreaks where there's a high attack rate and a high mortality rate, that's very tremendous concern. But sometimes death is expected in nursing home residents, especially in nursing home residents who are receiving palliative care or hospice care. And there may be other outcomes that are of interest, such as are residents having to be hospitalized more frequently, and are outbreaks occurring that are diminishing health status, diminishing physical function, affecting the quality of the life of the resident. So just because residents don't die or have to be hospitalized, I think there are still outbreaks that can cause pretty significant negative impacts, and we have to be concerned with that. Some additional challenges include the fact that for nursing home residents who are in nursing home for a long period of time, this is really a home environment and they're really residents and not patients. So there are some things that we have to think more carefully about in terms of implementation, such as moving patients out of a room in which they've been for a long time and may have a number of personal items, but in a room that has two patients, a semi-private room, two residents, moving them to a private room, that may incur some psychosocial impact on the resident. So isolation and cohorting are not as straightforward sometimes in the long-term care and nursing home environment as in the hospital. Certainly in nursing homes, nurse staffing is suboptimal. I think that we have an excellent nursing workforce in nursing home and long-term care, but I think we freely admit through a number of studies and position papers that we need more staffing. And so the fact that nursing staffing is suboptimal in terms of numbers makes it difficult sometimes to implement the interventions that are necessary. In most nursing homes and long-term care facilities, there's a very limited medical provider presence. You may not see physicians or physician extenders, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants as often as you see in the hospital. And that poses a challenge in terms of implementing interventions quickly. Medical record documentation is more sparse, and the availability of laboratory diagnostic studies is more limited. I think in the U.S., another challenge is that two-thirds of the nursing homes in the U.S. are essentially in the for-profit industry. And this is not to impugn the for-profit industry, but in a healthcare industry that is underfunded, for-profit sector makes it, again, challenging to implement some of the interventions that we may know work in terms of preventing infectious disease outbreaks, but tend to be costly. So these are challenges that you'll be doing in long-term care. And next, I would like to talk briefly about the key aspects of outbreak investigation in long-term care facilities. I think the most important thing to recognize is that every long-term care facility should have an infection control plan. And beyond just having a written plan, there really should be a program. Nursing homes may not have a full-time, and often don't have a full-time infection control professional. In the nursing home that I work in, we work with the infection control professional in the medical center in the acute care hospital. And she is available for consultation and to be part of our infection control committee, but we don't have a full-time infection control professional in the facility, in the nursing home facility. And so this is a challenge in terms of designing and implementing the program. At a minimum, a director of nursing, the medical director, and the administrator should be part of the infection control team. And if available, nurse managers on various wards and units should be participating in the infection control team. And if you have access to a pharmacy or microbiology professionals, infectious disease experts, infection control practitioners, that makes the infection control team for the nursing home even stronger. I think in terms of an outbreak, there are two important questions to ask very early. One is if you are seeing a number of cases of a respiratory disease or a GI disease, I think you have to ask yourself, is this surveillance artifact? By surveillance artifact, we mean that there's a new nurse or there's a new practitioner who suddenly has begun to identify diseases that are occurring, conditions that are occurring, but these conditions have been endemic and really aren't changing. It's just that the new practitioner has arrived on the scene and is beginning to report some of these things. Sometimes they need investigation, and sometimes they just represent endemic disease. The second question is, once you've decided that this is not surveillance artifact and this is truly a new outbreak that needs investigation, you have to decide to do that investigation. And in doing that investigation, you need a case definition, a line listing, you need to ascertain cases, develop the person, place, and time that we're all familiar with in terms of the temporal aspects of the outbreak. You need to develop some preliminary hypotheses and evaluate those hypotheses, implement your interventions. And I think those of us who have been involved in outbreaks in a long-term care environment know that implementing interventions often is one of the first things you do before you've completed your investigation, especially interventions to prevent further morbidity and mortality in the nursing home population. And I'll mention that a little bit later. And then at the end of the outbreak, I think you want to evaluate the impact of your interventions and evaluate the impact of your investigation so that you can use that for future outbreaks. On the next slide, I have, this is a very simplistic, simplified example of a line listing, but here we have in a nursing home an outbreak of individuals who have a respiratory infection or presumed respiratory infection. If you look on the horizontal axis at the top, you'll see the various variables that are collected. Certainly one could collect a number of other variables. In some nursing homes, some of these variables may not be as necessary or applicable. But we've got at least at a minimum age, sex, the location of the resident, when the onset of symptoms occurred, which symptoms were present, which studies were done that were done were positive. And then a couple of factors that just to make the point that group exposures may be very important in terms of residents' risk for infection. So in this particular line listing, if you look at the yellow circle, here we can see that the cases are spread out throughout this hypothetical facility on different floors and in different sections of the particular floor. We do see that in patient case 3 and case 4, we have a couple of residents who are in the same room, so there may be a risk for transmission there. If you look at the chest x-ray and culture columns, then at the very bottom you'll see a red circle. And here this points out that in terms of developing your case definition, you have to be sensitive that some of the diagnostic tests that we would expect to be positive in a younger, healthier population may not be. So you may have, for instance, in case number 5, a 90-year-old who has symptoms of cough and fever but whose chest x-ray is negative. And this can be because of dehydration and other variables. Also in this resident, the culture was negative, and this can be because either the resident had difficulty in producing a sputum, if a sputum culture was sent, or in this case a throat swab that was done may not be positive because of the technique of the throat swab. So you can't just assume that if the culture is negative in this case, but the resident had a clinical syndrome similar to the other residents, that they didn't have whatever the respiratory infection is in this particular outbreak. And then in the final column, which is physical therapy, you can see that all of these residents were exposed to physical therapy. And in particular, in this particular nursing home, this is a group activity, and this is certainly a setting in which transmission could have occurred for a respiratory outbreak. So again, this is just an example to help you think through some of the things that you will need to collect in a long-term care or nursing home outbreak. Again, this is a simple example of various epidemic curves. On the vertical axis, we have the number of cases, and on the horizontal axis, we would put the time after the initial index case. If you look at the three curves, the first curve, the green curve, is a point source, which means that, for example, in a typical foodborne outbreak, everyone was exposed to a particular source at a particular time, and the outbreak occurred very quickly and then tailed off. If you look at propagation, which is the red line, you can see that there was initially an outbreak which could have been a point source, and then that fell off and you got a second peak, which in this particular case means that there was transmission within the nursing home. In the third line, a common source, which is a source which is continuing to expose residents, and once more and more residents have had the particular infection, you'll finally see the outbreak begin to die off toward the end of that particular curve. So three different forms, and these can take many different forms, but this can help you orient your thinking in terms of what types of exposures might have been related to the outbreak. On the next slide, I want to pose some questions to ask about your infection control plan and program. In your facility, your long-term care facility, is there a dedicated infection control professional, even a part-time infection control professional, responsible for the program? Is that ICP trained? And even if you don't have a fully trained and certified infection control professional, let's say, for example, the director of nursing in your facility is the person charged with running the infection control program. Does that individual have any training in infection control? I think this is an important aspect that will help them be more effective. Does the infection control professional, if there is one, train staff? And I think this is becoming more and more apparent, certainly to me and to others, that we need to have ongoing training in nursing homes and long-term care facilities because there is a tremendous amount of staff turnover in long-term care facilities. Second, who really provides the care for the residents? And here we know that there are licensed and registered nursing staff who provide medications and a lot of the clinical care, but the day-to-day care such as bathing, dressing, helping with various activities of daily living may be provided by certified nursing assistants who have very little formal training. And in this case, educational and training materials and programs should really be geared to their level of medical sophistication. And they should have materials and programs really tailored to where they are in terms of their development. What's the reporting chain? This is something I wrestle with a lot in the nursing home in which I work. Whenever a nurse's aide, for example, a nursing assistant, identifies that a resident has a fever or is not well, does that nursing assistant or nurse's aide know to report rapidly to the registered or certified nursing staff? And then when the registered or certified nursing staff have this report, do they know to then report that on to the infection control professional, the director of nurses, or the medical director? I think it's important to identify this reporting chain in your facility. I think planning ahead on how you will handle isolation and cohorting of individuals in an outbreak is very important. You also, I think, especially with influenza, should have a plan for handling mass treatment and vaccination. When we have influenza outbreaks, there are situations in which you will need to provide prophylactic antiviral medications or revaccination to residents in the entire facility. And this is dependent on each physician ordering medications for each patient for whom they care, this could be really delayed. I think you have to really develop a plan so that the medical director or some other individual can be charged with doing this in a way that supplies antiviral medication or revaccination to the whole facility in a timely fashion. And lastly, how will you monitor and restrict visitors during an outbreak? Will you close the facility to new admissions? Will you close the facility to visitors? I think these are important questions to address ahead of time. Finally, I want to talk just briefly about infection control precautions. I think we all know that standard precautions we use in all residents, and then for certain types of infections, other precautions are recommended. These precautions have been promoted by the Centers for Disease Control for a number of years and other professional societies, and they've really been geared toward acute care hospitals, but we are certainly having to adapt these infection control guidelines for long-term care and use them. For some types of GI outbreaks, some would recommend contact precautions. I think this is prudent in some situations, but again, dependent on local resources and local facility protocols. Droplet precautions for influenza has been recommended. Airborne precautions, which are primarily for tuberculosis and a few other agents, are really not for most long-term care facilities or nursing homes available because of the need for negative pressure rooms. So I think in a situation where there is, for example, a TB outbreak, that would require transfer to the acute care facility for airborne isolation. On the next slide, this is a table that goes through the various components of the infection control precautions and the various types of precautions. This is referenced to the classic article by Julie Garner in the American Journal of Infection Control that described the CDC's recommendations regarding precautions. These precautions are being revised currently and should be coming out fairly soon. And they will have more focus. They won't be specific for long-term care. They will have more focus on particular issues in long-term care. So let's move on to the two main clinical areas today, respiratory infections and gastrointestinal infections. Let's start with respiratory infection outbreaks in long-term care. Mark Loeb, one of the leading investigators in the world in this area, did a very nice paper a few years ago in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, which helped us understand some of the microbial etiology of outbreaks in long-term care facilities. He looked at five long-term care facilities in Ontario over a three-year period and found that about 37 to 40% of the residents were affected by one of these outbreaks over that three-year period. The outbreaks occurred year-round, and there really wasn't a seasonal pattern. I think this varies some depending on which agent you're talking about. In this particular study, they looked at all agents. If you're talking about influenza, we know there's a seasonal pattern to that, and for some of the other agents, there may be a seasonal pattern. But in general, outbreaks could occur throughout the year. The chief pathogens in terms of viruses were influenza, parainfluenza, and respiratory syncytial virus. For bacterial pathogens, Legionella and Chlamydia pneumoniae were the primary bacterial pathogens associated with outbreaks. On the next slide, you can see some of the symptoms that were present in residents, and this looked at about 1,000 residents overall, of which 400 or so was a case patient in one of the outbreaks. Of patients who had symptoms, 83% had cough, 40% had fever, and 45% had coryza. The important point here is that these symptoms don't really help you differentiate between the various agents. They can be very common symptoms with any of the agents that cause respiratory infection outbreaks. In terms of outcomes from the outbreaks, 15% of the residents in these various outbreaks developed pneumonia, 12% had to be transferred to a hospital, and 8% died. So let's move on to a specific pathogen that is of interest, certainly influenza. On the next slide, influenza virus, as we know, is a single-stranded RNA virus, and the two virus types that we are concerned about in terms of human disease are A and B. We know that epidemics have been reported since the 1500s, and the one epidemic that people refer back to when talking about the severity of an influenza epidemic was the pandemic, the worldwide epidemic that occurred in 1918 and 19, in which 21 million people died around the world. And so in a setting where a pandemic occurs, and this can be because of a new virus type or strain emerging, as we are hearing more reports of avian flu in Asia. This is certainly creating more concern that we may see a pandemic from avian flu. We know that there will be limited immunity, limited to no immunity, and this can affect worldwide all populations and all age groups. I think an interesting feature of pandemics is that if you look at the distribution by age of deaths, actually deaths occur not just in older people, but can occur in all ages, all age groups. And I think this is, again, a particular concern when we're talking about a pandemic strain. If we talk about the clinical characteristics of influenza, the incubation period is typically 1 to 5 days. Respiratory transmission occurs with viral shedding, and that can occur about 5 to 10 days later in the end of the incubation period through the symptomatic period. The symptoms typically associated with influenza are fever, non-productive cough, myalgia, sore throat, and headache. I've been impressed in some outbreaks that I've been involved with in nursing homes that often we'll see some cases of residents who developed a high fever, but early on don't develop much in terms of respiratory illness. So I think that's something to be on the lookout for, too, if you have residents who are developing high fever and don't have evidence of other types of bacterial infection. And it's during a flu epidemic period, a flu season, that be a concern in terms of flu. In a non-pandemic year, in a usual year, 95% of all the deaths that occur because of influenza occur in people over 65, so the typical population group that we're talking about this afternoon. And in terms of residents in long-term care who develop influenza-like illness and develop influenza symptoms and have what we think is presumed influenza, the institution of antivirals for treatment is needed early on, and consideration for prophylaxis of other residents in the nursing home is important. Next slide. Influenza vaccine should be given to all nursing home residents each year. This typically occurs in October and early November. We know that from previous studies that the influenza vaccine appears to be about 50% effective in preventing respiratory illness in pneumonia and hospitalization, and 60 to 70% effective in preventing death. Again, in a couple of outbreaks that I've been involved with recently in long-term care, I've been impressed that residents who are vaccinated appear to have, if they develop influenza, appear to have a much milder clinical disease than residents who are not vaccinated. So even though influenza wasn't prevented, they certainly do much better in terms of the clinical presentations. On the next slide, I just want to, again, reiterate why we vaccinate long-term care residents. Certainly, we know the residents are at risk for complications from influenza and pneumococcal disease. We know these diseases have outbreak potential because of the group living conditions. And we know that that's true for Streptococcus pneumoniae, where we're seeing more and more antibiotic-resistant strep pneumo. And we are seeing outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant strep pneumo in facilities where there's very low pneumococcal vaccination rates. On the next slide, just a few points about influenza outbreaks. There aren't any good definitions that are universally accepted. Facilities in some states have, some organizations have definitions. They tend to be either some number or percentage of a particular unit or ward in a long-term care facility in which residents have influenza-like illness, or 2 to 3 residents within 48 to 72 hours who are geographically located together developing influenza-like symptoms. This is something that you need to address within your own facility and have a feel for what type of definition you want to use. Certainly, if you have even one case of culture-positive or rapid test-positive influenza in your facility, I think it has to raise your level of concern that there's an outbreak, because the potential for outbreak in this setting is so high. If an outbreak does occur, chemoprophylaxis with antiviral agents should be considered. Revaccination should also be considered late in the season. I'm currently involved in a nursing home where there appears to be a small influenza B outbreak. And because all of the residents were immunized in October, we're now considering revaccination. And so sometimes late in the season, this may be a helpful strategy. I think during an outbreak, you want to reinforce standard precautions. Standard precautions, good hand hygiene, are things that healthcare workers should always be following, but certainly during the outbreak, you need to reinforce this. You want to consider isolation or cohorting of those residents who have influenza-like illness, certainly those who are rapid test positive or culture positive, until their clinical symptoms have diminished. You want to limit group activities and visitors, and if you have a lot of cases, a large outbreak, you may need to close the long-term care facility or the ward to new admissions. The next slide is taken from the Annals of Internal Medicine, and the main point about this slide, this is a slide that's from a paper on decision analysis about whether to do antiviral testing or to just begin empiric antiviral treatment in an older population. And in this case, on the vertical axis, the decision analysis researchers have put the risk for hospitalization. So this looks at the population characteristics. Is this a population that's pretty healthy and at low risk for hospitalization, or a population that's pretty debilitated and at high risk for hospitalization? And across the top on the horizontal axis, they have the type of season you have. So this is the peri-influenza season before and after the main season, during the peak season when there are high attack rates in the community, and during a regional epidemic. And if you look at most of the gray boxes, most of this decision analysis suggests that beginning in empirical antivirals is a more effective strategy. In those settings where there's either a low risk for hospitalization or there's low incidence of disease, you may consider not beginning antiviral therapy in vaccinated residents and only doing that in unvaccinated residents. But again, in a setting where you've got either you're during the peak of the season or during a regional epidemic, I think it's more prudent, and this decision analysis would support going ahead and starting antiviral medications prior to getting the results of your antiviral testing. So in the next slide, I just want to reiterate the various components of a prevention and control program for influenza. Vaccination is the absolute foundation. Having your healthcare workers use good hand hygiene and respiratory etiquette is critical. Antiviral medications for prophylaxis should be started in a facility where there's an outbreak, a large outbreak, and you've already vaccinated residents. Antiviral treatment should be used in those residents who develop symptoms, and that has to be begun within 48 hours to be effective. And then in some cases where there's a lot of respiratory secretions, you may want to put residents on droplet precautions. In terms of the respiratory cough etiquette protocol, this is available from the CDC website, and it's fairly simple. Cover your nose and mouth when you're coughing or sneezing. Use tissues to contain your respiratory secretions. Perform hand hygiene after contact with respiratory secretions or contaminated objects and materials. And in healthcare facilities, make sure that there are tissues available, there are no-touch waste receptacles, and that these can be provided in a setting that is convenient and also provided along with alcohol-based hand rubs or sinks. On the next slide, indications for antiviral therapy, there are two general areas, one for prophylaxis and the other for treatment. For prophylaxis, in individuals who have a contraindication to vaccination, one could consider doing prophylaxis throughout the entire influenza season, although I probably would wait until there's community activity that suggests that there's actually some flu in your community. In a facility following suspected exposure or when community activities increased is another indication for beginning prophylaxis. And this varies substantially from community to community and facility to facility. So it again points out that in your facility, you should have a plan, an infection control plan, and you should discuss with your medical director and your director of nursing and whatever other consultants you need what your plan will be during the season in terms of implementing prophylaxis. Prophylaxis, if begun within 48 hours, should be 70-90% effective in preventing severe influenza disease, although, as I mentioned before, as with vaccination, you may see clinical symptoms develop, but not as significant or as impactful on the residents as they would have without prophylaxis. In terms of treatment, this should be begun within 48 hours of the onset of influenza-like symptoms. And it's important to begin this in a timely fashion, so it again points out that if you have a setting where practitioners are not readily available and there's a delay both either in flu diagnostics or in terms of treatment, beginning treatment, that you may need for your medical director to take a much more active role. On the next slide, we have some of the drugs that are used for antiviral treatment and prophylaxis for influenza. Amantadine has been used for a long time. It does have some CNS and GI side effects. Ramantadine seems to have less of those. Renal function is important for both of these in terms of an elderly population, although beginning at a low dose of 100 milligrams once a day should, for Ramantadine and Amantadine, should be okay in terms of residents who have significant limitations or have a renal insufficiency. If you're not able to obtain tests of renal function like a creatinine and BUN, again, the lower dose may be what you want to start with. In terms of neuraminidase inhibitors, ulcitamivir tends to be the drug that is prescribed most often. It's good for both influenza A and for B, whereas amantadine and ranitidine are only good for influenza A. On the next slide, I want to mention nursing home acquired pneumonia. Certainly, influenza is a very strong risk factor for developing nursing home acquired pneumonia, along with other risk factors. The incidence of nursing home acquired pneumonia is 13 to 48% in terms of the infections in long-term care. And the really important point about nursing home acquired pneumonia is that the mortality rate can be as high as 44%. Primary risk factors for nursing home pneumonia are swallowing difficulty, inability to take oral medications, witnessed aspiration, and these really speak to the substantially increased risk of aspiration that we see in this population. Certainly, the lack of influenza vaccination leads to increased risk for influenza, which then leads to an increased risk for post-viral bacterial pneumonia. Use of sedative, hypnotics, and cognitive impairment increase the risk for pneumonia. In residents who have influenza and then develop post-viral bacterial pneumonia, it's a major cause of morbidity and mortality, and pneumococcus is the leading cause of bacterial pneumonia in this setting in long-term care residents. Now, what are the predictors of mortality if a resident develops pneumonia? Certainly, if they're more dependent in terms of their activities of daily living, if they present hypothermic, if they have an increased BUN suggesting that they're dehydrated, if they develop an infiltrate on chest x-ray, or if they have tachypnea, all of these are independently associated with an increased risk for mortality. Looking on the next slide, the acute pneumonia mortality in long-term care residents, this is the impact of the ADL score. This is a study by Bob Muter in Pittsburgh. It was published many years ago. And I think it's important in pointing out that residents who have physical immobility, limitations in their physical function, are certainly at increased risk of mortality. In this case, the ADL score, the higher the score, the more dependent the resident is. For those residents who had a score of less than 11, which meant they, for the most part, could, with assistance, do most activities of daily living, they had a 5% or less risk of 14-day mortality. For those residents who were 11 to 15 on the score, meaning that they were completely dependent in one of the activities of daily living and also needed assistance in several activities, these residents had a higher risk of mortality, about 10%. And then those residents who were essentially bedbound and needed help in terms of feeding and dressing, toileting, these residents had a much higher risk of mortality, close to 25%. Now on the next slide, we have invasive pneumococcal disease. This is the burden by age group for the nation in the U.S. This comes from the CDC data system, the Active Bacterial Core Surveillance. If you look, the highest risk of invasive pneumococcal disease is in the elderly population that we see would typically inhabit a nursing home or long-term care facility. If you look at the far right on that graph, you'll see that individuals who are 75 and older have some of the highest rates, second only to little children less than 2. If you look at the case fatality rate, however, the case fatality rate is clearly the highest in the older population that we see in most nursing homes. On the next slide is a study looking at the incidence of invasive Streptococcus pneumoniae in older adults in long-term care, comparing the long-term care facilities with community living elders. This is a study that we did here at CDC a couple of years ago, and we actually found a fourfold higher incidence of invasive pneumococcal disease in long-term care facility living elders. The scary part of this was not only was the incidence much higher, but we found that the non-susceptible or resistant strep pneumoniae were about 10 times higher when we looked at susceptibility to levofloxacin, one of the more common drugs used in long-term care facilities. If you look at the majority of strep pneumoniae serotypes in long-term care, they're similar to the community living older adults, and most of these are covered by the current 23-valent polysaccharide vaccine. On the next slide, another study that we did here in Atlanta looking at 6 long-term care facilities to look at which antibiotics are used, we found that over 50% of the antibiotics prescribed for any indication, whether that be urinary tract infection, respiratory infection, were fluoroquinolones, which again points to this concern for increasing fluoroquinolone resistance for strep pneumonia in the long-term care population. Finally, I want to end up by covering a couple of key points on the next slide in terms of respiratory infection outbreaks. First of all, influenza and pneumococcal vaccination should be the foundation of your strategy to prevent outbreaks. Active surveillance should be conducted during the flu season, especially for respiratory outbreaks. There should be institutional preparation and commitment in terms of influenza. The ability to rapidly obtain rapid testing for influenza is key. Also, the institution of antiviral prophylaxis and infection control isolation are very important. And lastly, to remember that even if the outbreak tends to be a viral respiratory outbreak, secondary bacterial pneumonia is an important complication occurring in these outbreaks. Now let's move on to GI outbreaks in long-term care. And I'm on the slide now entitled Diarrhea in Nursing Home Patients or Residents. And I want to just point out very quickly that diarrhea in nursing home residents isn't always because of an infection. There are a number of non-infectious causes that I think are probably more commonly associated with diarrhea than even infections. Of the infections, there are a number of viruses, foodborne, and parasitic causes of diarrhea. On the next slide, we have the various etiologic agents in a little more detail. So the various viruses, Calliciviridae, the Rotaviridae, a number of other viruses, parasites, and a number of bacteria. On the next slide, just to highlight a few selected foodborne outbreaks in long-term care. The first one was an unusual form of salmonella that was seen in a Tennessee long-term care facility. In that facility, 14% of the residents developed diarrhea. 244 healthcare workers were assessed in this particular outbreak. And if you looked at the healthcare workers, 27% of the laundry workers also had this particular diarrhea. Only 3% of the nurses and 4% of the kitchen staff had diarrhea. Now, the kitchen staff was probably the index case, but the point here was that the laundry workers didn't know that this was potentially an infectious diarrhea and were not using gloves whenever they were handling laundry, and this led to a very high attack rate in the healthcare workers working in the laundry. In terms of food, Clostridium perfringens in an Australian long-term care facility, an outbreak occurred, 25 residents were affected. In this particular outbreak, pureed food was being provided to the residents, and it sat out for too long and wasn't reheated and led to this outbreak, pointing out the need to control the food distribution in your facility in a way that it doesn't increase the risk for outbreaks. Campylobacteriosis at a senior center was associated with a Hawaiian luau, which points to some of these special events that occur in long-term care facilities. In this particular special event, there was raw meat being used that was contaminated, and this cross-contaminated vegetables that were being provided. So again, pointing to some important issues around foodborne outbreak in long-term care. Next, viral outbreaks. Norovirus is probably the leading cause of outbreaks in long-term care. There are a number of publications on norovirus in the long-term care setting. This is just one in a Washington long-term care facility where almost 60% of the residents and, interestingly, 40% of the healthcare workers developed norovirus. On molecular typing, the norovirus appeared to be primarily occurring in the debilitated residents, and also there appeared to be evidence of healthcare worker transmission, which suggests that in the debilitated residents, the healthcare workers were handling the residents in terms of their fecal incontinence, were not using good hand hygiene, and that led to further transmission to other patients. In Maryland, where norovirus type outbreak occurred, again, we had a high attack rate in over 50% of the residents and almost 50% of the healthcare workers. And in this particular situation, the nurse who was the index case and was ill worked for several days with illness and did not leave work, and this probably led to repeated episodes of transmission. On the next slide, on rotavirus, rotavirus appears to also be an important pathogen. We think of rotavirus in young children, but it appears to also be an important pathogen in long-term care. This is a study done in Australia. We're looking for viral etiology in a number of healthcare aged care facilities. While it's true the predominant pathogen was norovirus, over 10% of the outbreaks occurred because of rotavirus. These outbreaks typically occurred in midwinter to mid-spring. They presented with diarrhea and vomiting for 1 to 5 days. On the next slide, I want to talk briefly about Clostridium difficile. We know that Clostridium difficile appears to be becoming more common. 25% of all antibiotic-associated diarrhea is C. diff, which results in about 300,000 cases per year. Now, this is in all settings, both nursing home and hospitals. There are a number of antibiotics that have been frequently associated with C. diff, including clindamycin. However, C. diff can really occur with any antibiotic. We know that in hospitalized patients, colonization occurs in about 20% of the patients, and two-thirds of those patients are completely asymptomatic. Spores can lead to person-to-person transmission even after symptoms have abated. In terms of the pathophysiology, on the next slide, you get disruption of fecal flora with antibiotic therapy that leads to colonization with C. diff. And C. diff has several strains. One's a non-toxigenic strain, which really leads to no disease. But the toxigenic strains can lead to either a very inflammatory bowel disease that occurs with toxin A or massive watery diarrhea with toxin B. Some strains of C. diff can have both toxins present, which can cause very severe disease, especially in the elderly. In terms of the diagnosis, there are a number of ways to do diagnosis for C. diff: stool culture, cytotoxin assay, and ELISA test. Cytotoxin assay is, I think, most typical for most facilities. Endoscopy can be used if there's a complicated patient, but it's not recommended for routine diagnosis. In terms of treatment, stopping the inciting antibiotic is key. Avoiding antiperistaltic drugs and opiates is also very important. And if antibiotic therapy is necessary, metronidazole is the preferred drug. Relapses are common and retreatment may be necessary. On the next slide, I point out that C. diff can present in an outbreak form. This is a C. diff outbreak that occurred here in Atlanta that was reported in the journal Clinical Infectious Disease that was associated with a formulary change from levofloxacin to gatofloxacin. So in this particular long-term care facility, a formulary change led to the replacement of levofloxacin with gatofloxacin for all infections. In this particular long-term care facility, the C. diff attack rate increased dramatically and approached 30%. When the formulary was changed back to levofloxacin, the C. diff rates went back down to their endemic rate. And the working hypothesis from this particular work has been that gatofloxacin does have an expanded anaerobic coverage, and that led to an increased colonization with C. diff and more disease with C. diff. I think this points out a key point in terms of a bacterial non-foodborne outbreak, especially if this is C. diff. If you see a change in some systematic factor like an antibiotic formulary, that may be a key to understanding how the outbreak has occurred. Next slide is controlling GI outbreaks. And on this slide, I just want to summarize a few of the points I've made. First of all, in GI outbreaks, diarrhea and vomiting are very common. Dehydration is very common and can be deadly. That's typically what nursing home residents will die of in a GI outbreak within the first couple of days, is because they have very severe dehydration. Transmission can occur very rapidly, and you have to consider using contact precautions and universal gloving. Hand hygiene and standard precautions should be used always among the residents and health care workers, and this should be emphasized again and again. You want to always engage the healthcare worker staff, and certainly that's nursing, but in a nursing home outbreak of a GI disease, you also need to engage the food workers and the environmental staff, because they may have a role in propagating the outbreak. And again, I just want to reiterate that in nursing home residents during a GI outbreak, hydration is so very important. Let's finish up by talking about some infection control considerations for outbreaks in long-term care. Now I'm on the slide entitled Long-Term Care Facilities Have Increased Infection Control Efforts, But Are Programs Sufficient? And this is a slide from a study from Barbara Goldrick for several years ago from Northeastern U.S. Long-Term Care Facilities. And I think the key points are that while most facilities had a designated infection control professional, 60% of those ICPs performed other jobs, and they only spent about 8 hours per week doing infection control tasks. Only half were trained in infection control, and only a quarter of these facilities had some type of physician with infection control interest. So I think you have to understand within your own facility what your resources and commitments are to infection control. Next slide is practical considerations. And again, in terms of infection control, I think the biggest thing to emphasize in both of these outbreaks, types of outbreaks, is hand hygiene. I think hand hygiene is absolutely crucial. It's very important. In GI outbreaks especially, you may want to consider universal glove use. Now, this would be glove use on entering the resident's room for any reason. And it just offers a higher level of protection. And this, in contrast to gowning and using full contact precautions, may be a practical alternative. And finally, in terms of infection control, using the respiratory etiquette protocol that I mentioned earlier is very important in respiratory outbreaks. On the next slide, just a word about hand hygiene adherence, and I don't think any of us would be surprised that in the studies that have been done to look at hand hygiene, the rates of adherence, even in ICU healthcare workers, is very low. Next slide is the self-reported factors for poor adherence with hand hygiene. There are several factors that are important that result in poor hand hygiene adherence. If the hand washing agents cause irritation and dryness, if sinks are inconveniently located, if there aren't soap and paper towels, if the healthcare workers are too busy or have insufficient time for good hand hygiene, if the particular facility is understaffed or overcrowded, if resident or patient needs take priority, if several things are occurring with a resident at one time, the healthcare worker may not wash or clean their hands after going from one activity to the next. And certainly, there is a belief system with healthcare workers where they believe that they're at low risk of acquiring infection from patients and at low risk for transmitting this to other patients or residents. On the next slide, we have the efficacy of hand hygiene preparations. We increasingly have moved toward alcohol-based hand rubs, which seem to be the best both in terms of killing bacteria and also viruses. Next slide is on the ability to kill bacteria, and here you see in the top line on the graph the ability of alcohol hand rubs to kill bacteria. This is analogous to their ability to kill viruses, and it's much better than either antimicrobial soap or plain soap. Now, on the next slide, the effect of alcohol hand rub on skin conditions. In studies looking at skin conditions using alcohol-based hand rubs, it's been found that actually alcohol hand rubs are better than soap and water, both in terms of self-reported skin scores and in terms of epidermal water content. On the next slide, we have the time spent cleansing hands. This is following one nurse during an 8-hour shift. During that 8-hour shift, following the current recommendations for hand washing using soap and water, the nurses spent 56 minutes washing their hands. In using an alcohol-based hand rub, only 18 minutes was required. So alcohol hand rubs are not only better at killing bacteria and viruses, they're also better on the hands, and they take less time than soap and water. On the next slide, we have the recommended hand hygiene technique. For hand rubs, you apply the hand rubs to the palm of one hand, rub the hands together, covering all surfaces until dry, and depending on the type of agent you use, the manufacturer instructions will give you the volume that's necessary. For hand washing, which is still important in terms of situations where the hands are soiled, visibly dirty, in that case you want to wash with water and soap and then apply alcohol hand rub. Hand washing, you wet the hands with water, apply soap, rub the hands together for at least 15 seconds. You rinse and dry with a disposable towel and use the towel to turn off the faucet. On the next slide, again, this is another study looking at hand washing spent with both soap and water and hand rub, and you can see that the hand rub is much superior in terms of the limited amount of time necessary to do good hand hygiene. On the next slide, I want to just summarize the talk for this afternoon. Respiratory and GI outbreaks can certainly be deadly in the vulnerable long-term care population. With respiratory outbreaks, the progression to full-blown bacterial pneumonia can result in very high mortality. In GI outbreaks, the very significant dehydration that can occur in residents can, again, lead to very high mortality. I think that prior planning is absolutely crucial in long-term care because of the limited resources we have. Surveillance, a plan for some type of surveillance during to detect respiratory outbreaks and GI outbreaks is important. It doesn't have to be sophisticated or complicated, but just a simple surveillance by the nurse managers or nursing staff to alert the infection control professional, medical director, and director of nursing when there's a suspected outbreak is very important. Having a well thought out, written infection control plan and an infection control team It's very important. And also establishing in your plan the authority to take rapid action, whether it be the institution of antiviral medications or the placement of residents on contact or droplet precautions. I think also to emphasize that in a nursing home environment, very simple interventions can make a huge difference in the propagation of these outbreaks. Making sure that all your residents are immunized is critical. Using good hand hygiene and reinforcing this, having alcohol-based hand rubs available is very important. And using simple respiratory etiquette during a respiratory outbreak can really, we think, have an impact on transmission. So that's all I have this afternoon. I want to again thank you for having me, and I hope this has been helpful.
Thank you, Dr. Richards. It has been, I think, very, very helpful. Many of those listening today are in the middle of an outbreak at their facilities or have just resolved an outbreak, you know, and probably some of them have an outbreak percolating that they just haven't noticed yet. And this has been very good information for all of us. Thank you very much for it. Thank you all for joining our teleclass today. Dr. Richards, I will say again, it was a real honor to spend this time with you. Thank you very much. Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.